can you imagine if this was how God was with us, that when we had a need and wanted to connect with him, that, you know, he blurted out, you know, not now, or I don't have time, or don't interrupt me. We would be a lot less inclined to approach God in prayer. And this is what happens in potentially in our parental relationships too, that we can become so busy with life events and taking care of, multiple things that we're not cultivating and relating to, we're not connecting with our children.
Parents have many responsibilities when it comes to raising children. On the top of the list, you might find providing a well-rounded educational experience, emphasizing a life with integrity, having high morals, and building a strong relationship with God. But how do we build independence in our children while teaching them to be dependent on God? With us today is Father Timothy Pavlatos, a licensed marriage and family therapist in the state of Oregon and a nationally certified counselor. He is also the associate pastor at St. John the Baptist Greek Orthodox Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Welcome, Father Timothy.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today. Not only are you a licensed therapist with a master's in counseling and divinity, but you and your wife have 9 children.
That's right. You'd think I would be an expert by this point in time, but I can assure you that I'm still in the learning curve.
So let's begin with that first question. How can you help your child become independent but still be able to maintain their dependence on God?
Well, hopefully by example, by the way that my wife and I live our own life in Christ. And I think, you know, the important thing is that we really need to teach our children from a very early age on how to be dependent on God in terms of how to seek God's help. And I find that that really comes by example in the home, the example that my wife and I set, but also teaching them when we dialogue with our children, if there's something they're struggling with in life, it could be maybe with one of their siblings or something at school or with some friends in the neighborhood or whatever it may be, it's an opportunity really to teach them to seek God's help, I would say primarily through prayer, and just to talk about that with them. And so from a very early age, we teach them to turn to God in times of need or in times of trouble or whatever the case may be. So I think right from the beginning, we're starting to cultivate in them this idea and this reality that they can always turn to God in prayer and to seek his help.
And that's a very natural and authentic way of teaching.
It is, and I think that, you know, we know that we're relational beings. The Trinity are relational beings, and so we're created in their image. And so we're created in the sense to relate to not only our Father in heaven, but to each other. So this is all a part of teaching our children how to relate to others. It's an opportunity to relate to God and to their siblings and to people around them through prayer and through dialogue and things like that. So this is just a natural part of life. I mean, children are going to be relating to others around them all the time, and we just want to help them realize that this is something that they can also do with God as well.
Can you explain a little bit more what it means to really relate with your children? I mean, in this day and age, for many people, that line can be crossed where parents just want to be, you know, their child's best friend, and they're on that level, and they don't want to be mean, or they don't want to be the disciplinarian. They just want to be their buddy. But that can backfire.
Yeah, I've never been a proponent or even like the idea of being my child's best friend. You know, when you think of friendship, we think of people who we can trust, people who we can open up to, people that will listen, who will be there for us. To me, that's a beautiful and wonderful thing, and that's something that parents ought to be doing. We don't need to define them as friends in that regard, because they are parents, and there's certainly a hierarchy. There's a difference there. So I think that the elements of friendship are also the elements of parenting. But the idea that we are equal is something that I've always, you know, stayed away with our children. And I've even said to them, I'm not your friend, I'm your father. But that's not to take away the idea that I'm going to relate to them in the same way that a good friend would relate to them. And to me, relating just simply means then connecting with them. And so the question could be, you know, how do we connect with our children? And I think the most important part of this is our attentiveness. You know, are we tuned in to our children? Are we sending them the message that they matter, that they're important and precious? Because this is the message that our Father in Heaven gives to us. Or are we too busy? Are we impatient, irritated? Are we running around most of the day passing over our children? I mean, can you imagine if this was how God was with us, that when we had a need and wanted to connect with him, that, you know, he blurted out, you know, not now, or I don't have time, or don't interrupt me, we would be a lot less inclined to approach God in prayer. And this is what happens in potentially in our parental relationships too, that we can become so busy with life events and taking care of, you know, multiple things that we're not cultivating and relating to. We're not connecting with our children. We're not there to be really attentive and tuned in to what's going on in their lives. And that sends a message to them that we can't always be approached. We're not able to connect with them. So what happens is they're going to start turning to other people and other things to connect in order to feel that sense of value and importance. In the realm of play therapy, one of the things that is taught to parents is called a 30-second burst of attention. And so if, let's say, I'm on the phone, like I am with you right now, and one of my little ones comes running up, I could be shushing them and using my hands to push them away or giving them a, you know, kind of a stern face, not now. But that's going to cause damage to that child. And so what I would do is I would say, could you please hold on for 30 seconds? And I'm not going to do that with you right now. One, because, you know, we're having this interview, and two, I don't have any of my children around by design.
Right.
But I would say, could you just hold on for 30 seconds? And then I would get down to my child and say, you know, what you have to say to me is important, and I really want to give you all of my attention. Right now I have to finish up this phone call. So if you just give me a few minutes, I'll come and find you, and then we can talk. So that sends the message to them that they are important and that they do matter and that I am interested in what's going on and that I have to take care of this matter here first. And then I go to them later, and I fulfill what I said. And so that sends a very powerful message to them.
Certainly. And then I think that when parents do build parameters into a child's life, you know, you have rules or certain things that are appropriate or inappropriate. If you have a true emotional connection, if you have a relationship then with that child believes you. You know, that child feels that those rules are meaningful. Whereas if the rules are there without the relationship, that can lead to rebellion.
Yeah, and that's a saying, too, that I came across in graduate school, that rules without relationships equals rebellion. And I find that to be true. And what you're saying is spot on. The stronger the connection we have with our children, the better chance or the better opportunity we're going to have with them following the instructions we give them or the boundaries that we're setting for them. It may not necessarily go over smoothly. They may not be jumping up and down for joy to say, oh, I'm so glad that you gave me that curfew, and that's a wonderful, 12 o'clock midnight is perfect. I mean, they're always going to want to stretch that, but you're not going to have that strong kickback and that sort of defiance and rebelliousness that could potentially come into play because you've built that relationship on solid ground. And so they're going to have that respect. And I had a conversation with one of my teenagers just last night who broke curfew. And so I sat down with her and I talked to her a little bit. And I said, you know, we set these boundaries in place for a reason. And I understand that at your age, you want to explore and spend a little bit more time out. Even if it's you're not doing anything wrong. I mean, I truly trust her. However, those boundaries and rules are there for a reason. And so while she didn't like the fact that I was going to cut her curfew back an hour, through our time, just our brief time of talking, she understood and she accepted it. She wasn't happy about it, but she accepted it, and she accepted the consequences too. And then I can express my appreciation for her and her willingness to do this and acknowledge how difficult it is and so forth and so on. But if my relationship with her hadn't been cultivated in such a way over the years that, you know, she's been in my life and I've been in hers, it probably wouldn't have gone that well. And it doesn't always go that well, but there's more opportunity that it goes well.
Right. Or at least that even if at that moment it doesn't go well, in some quiet time, they do sense to reflect that very real intuitive feeling in your gut that you know you knew better. You knew when you did that with your curfew, you were going to get in trouble.
Yeah.
And so let's move on a little bit to the concept of free will, because that balance of allowing that freedom in our children while still keeping them safe is certainly a very real fear for a lot of parents. And we do have free will. God gives us that. How do we try not to parent out of fear?
Yeah, this is very challenging. And I run across this not only in my own life, obviously with my own children and parenting along with my wife, but I run across it a lot with parents who come to me and say, you know, what should I do? You know, what sort of boundary should I put? And then they express their fears about what's going on. So it's very, very challenging. I think, you know, some of it is just common sense. You know, having said that, I think we want to give them freedom to explore and also freedom to return to us and know that they can venture out, but also know that they have a safe home base. And again, I think the work we do early on in life will have a lot to do with how these later years go, these teen years, when they're really wanting to develop a stronger sense of autonomy, which is developmentally where they are. But we want to raise good decision makers, not perfect decision makers, but good decision makers. And I know my kids are going to make mistakes, and they have made mistakes, and they're going to pay for some of those mistakes. But that's part of life. If we as parents were just to, you know, reflect back a little bit in our teenage years and young adult years, we could, I think, very easily see, you know, what it was like that our parents were going through, but that, you know, we wanted that freedom. We wanted to sort of push the boundaries a little bit and to explore. So we can understand that. And we also know that, you know, there are things that we did in life that we're not really proud of, and we've you know, perhaps caused harm to ourselves and harm to others. But I want my kids to know that, you know, when they do mess up, when they make poor choices, that they have a place to return to and not have the fear of hearing the words, "I told you so," or "you should have listened." So, you know, my wife and I talk a lot with our kids, and probably if you were to ask them, they say that we have too many, you know, one-on-one meetings or small group meetings with them. But hopefully we're also there, you know, giving them the message that we want to listen even more than talk. But I think they have a very clear idea of what we expect and what we hope for in them and what God desires for them. And this is not to guilt them, but really to inform them, because we want them to know that the way of Christ is life and freedom. And we want our children to know that every decision they make is going to have an impact on them, for better or for worse. So just to try to help them to become critical thinkers, because children developmentally don't think things through before they do something. They think of something that would be fun and exciting, and then they just impulsively do it, and they don't really think about it until afterwards, and sometimes it's a little bit too late. So that's just a developmental part of life, and as parents, we know that, and we accept that to a degree. There's another rule of thumb in play therapy that says it's not always what you do, it's what you do after you've done it.
Good one.
And so we don't always make the best choices as parents. We don't always say and do the right thing, and we do make mistakes. And that's normal, just like our children, okay? So it's not that we're sort of dead in the water at that moment. We can always rebound. I mean, it really speaks to repentance. It speaks to forgiveness. It speaks to starting over, starting fresh, and so forth and so on. So, you know, with our kids, I don't hesitate to express my concern and my fear, too, with them. So, you know, I am fearful. I'm honest with you. I am fearful that, you know, this may happen or that may happen. And I just want you to know that, you know, I'm saying these things because you're precious to me and I love you. And I'm concerned for your safety and your health. So I just want you to know that from a heart-to-heart, you know, perspective as your father or as your mother. And I think that sort of openness and honesty and transparency is really good in terms of relationship building and trying to help them look a little bit into our life and what we're experiencing as parents, although they won't be able to fully understand it until later in life, still I think it gives them just a little glimpse into what's going on. And I think that's healthy for them.
And basically, that's a vulnerability. It's being able to be transparent and vulnerable to some degree to your children that, you know, I'm human and some of the decisions I make may or, you know, may not be the best. But why don't you talk to us a little bit about that?
You know, I work as a marriage and family therapist. The people that I see mostly are couples. And it's really fascinating to see. I operate, out of an attachment theory in part. And so when I work with couples, I really I do a little exploration with them individually, at least for one session, looking at their family of origin and their relationships that they had with their parents and siblings and extended family growing up. And it gives me a sense of how they developed a sense of self, their self, what we call their self-concept. And from that, you know, it really translates into then their relationship with their spouse, who I'm working with. For children who grew up in a home where they were nurtured in such a way that they were led to be or made to feel important and valued and as a person and so forth, develop a healthy sense of self. Children who grew up in a home where they can't do anything right, they get the sense that they can't do anything right, that they're never good enough, they can never make their parents happy, that they're always being yelled at or being criticized or they feel judged or whatever. These kids grow up with a poor sense of self, and I would even say a false sense of self, because none of that is true, because we all have worth, we all have value, we all have importance, and we know that just through our relationship with God and what He sent His Son to do for us in this life. So we can grow up with a distorted sense of self, and that's what we take into our relationships later on. And that's how we begin to, we then relate out of that sort of false, distorted concept of who we are as a person. And that can be really, really hard. So when we're talking about how we relate to our children now at this young age of life, they're going to take that into their adult relationships and with their eventual spouses. So if they go into those relationships with a concept of themselves that's distorted, then it's not going to allow the relationship really to flourish on healthy ground. And if you have two individuals coming from these sort of what we call insecure attachment bases, whether it's a sense of anxiousness or a sense of avoidance or whatever, that's going to make it very difficult for that couple to have a strong connection and transparency, because they're going to be operating out of something that they're really not in that sense, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And in that, you know, I think that's why it's really important for us as parents that while we're being observant of our children and we're being tuned in and attentive to what's going on in them, and we do that mostly by observing their behavior, we also have to have sort of this dual process where we're being really attentive to ourselves and what's going on inside of us. And what sort of things am I operating out of, resolved or unresolved? If I'm operating out of a lot of fear, where is that fear coming from, and why is that fear there, and how is it impacting the way I parent? And there was a really fantastic book that came out a few years ago called Parenting from the Inside Out by Daniel Siegel and Mary Hartzell, and it really speaks to that, how we parent from our experiences in life. So that's a really important part when we look at this whole topic that we're discussing. What are we parenting out of in terms of our own experience? Not just in terms of our faith experience, but in terms of our relational experience too.
So, is a person's self-concept then changeable?
Absolutely, and really, I think the research over the last probably 15, 20 years has really pointed to that. You know, there's a lot of literature out there today in terms of interpersonal neurobiology, which is a term that comes out of Dr. Daniel Siegel's work, and just about the brain and what they call plasticity, that the brain can actually change shape through the relationship experiences that it has. And they've done a lot of research in children who have been brought up in abused home and how even the size of their brain is smaller by comparison to kids their same age that are brought up in a home that's more nurturing. But in any relationship we have, it creates these sort of connections in our brain, these neural connections that gives us an experience, and that experience then impacts the way that we see ourselves and the way we see others. So you can have someone grow up in a home where they've developed sort of a distorted, unhealthy sense of self, but later in life they can have a relationship with a teacher or a coach or even a friend's parent, where there's this caring, more nurturing, empathic, attentiveness, and so forth. And that experience with that other person then begins to heal that person's concept of themselves. So it can change. And I've witnessed this in people that I've worked with and even friends and family members. So that's the good news, and that's what's so beautiful. And when I think about, you know, Scripture, I think about the woman who was caught in adultery. And as you recall in the story, there were those who had stones in their hands, and they were getting ready to stone her to death because of the sin. And Jesus comes up, and as the story unfolds, you know, he asks, you know, if there's anyone among you who has a stone in your hand is without sin, then throw the stone. Well, they all drop the stone and they walk away. Well, that woman, you know, by that experience of Christ and his presence in her life and what he did, changed that woman forever. And, you know, we could argue, though we don't know, that that woman may have never had any sort of compassionate interaction prior to that time. I mean, we don't know what her early childhood was like, but, you know, the fact that she was living a life as a harlot would probably point to some things. But the point of this story is that the encounter she had with Christ transformed her so that she became a disciple. And that's really the same, I'll use the word lightly, the same power we have as parents to really transform our children. In that sense, that when we are Christ-like parents, that we have that power, so to speak, to really transform our children's lives. So whether we feel like we've been adequate as parents in the past or not, and no matter where our children are presently, we still have that hope, and we still have that opportunity to turn to Christ and to pray and to reach out. Even if our kids cut us off, let's say, with whatever they're going through, we still have that opportunity to reach out to God, because where we fail and where we cannot reach out any further, that's where God picks up, and he can penetrate the heart and mind of any person and any of our children, no matter you know, what's going on. You know, our love for our children is beyond measure, but the love that God has for us and for our children is beyond our comprehension, you know. But I think that we always need to look toward our own spiritual growth and development as parents, first and foremost, because that's going to be sort of the guiding light and principle for us as people. And if you would allow me, I'd like to just read a very brief saying by Saint Porphyrios, which I think really sort of sums all this up. And he says, "What saves and makes for good children is the life of the parents in the home. The parents need to devote themselves to the love of God. They need to become saints in their relation to their children through their mildness, patience, and love. They need to make a new start every day with a fresh outlook, renewed enthusiasm, and love for their children. And the joy that will come to them, the holiness that will visit them, will shower grace on their children."
Simply and beautifully said.
Yeah, I think it really sums it up.
It does. Thank you so very much for spending some time with us today, Father Timothy. Any last closing words or websites or books that you'd like to refer people to for more information?
We first and foremost are always looking for resources that are orthodox. And while there's more and more coming out, especially over the last 10 years or so, we still have a lot more that we can offer, and I think that it's happening. A recent book that came out, which I like because it has a lot of offerings from clergymen to contemporary elders to saints of the church, is a book called Orthodox Christian Parenting, Cultivating God's Creation. I found that book to be beautiful and very well written. As far as some books outside of Orthodoxy, but they're not contrary to Orthodox teaching, but books that I have found helpful, just in the sense of trying to understand my own child's development. One is The Whole Brain Child. Another one is The Science of Parenting. And then the third one was a book I mentioned earlier, Parenting from the Inside Out. But I think the key to this topic is to listen to our children in order to understand them and to love them. I mean, this is the key to it all.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us today, Father.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.